nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and start today's lecture. And today I'm going to talk about assessing nanotoxicity at the single cell level. The whole course, the emphasis on the course in nanomedicine has been every time we try to understand something, we try to understand it one cell at a time. And so what does nanotoxicity mean one cell at a time, and how do we make the measurements? So we're going to use some things that we've learned earlier in the course and go through a number of different concepts. Believe it or not, nanotoxicity, there are more than one way for a cell to die, and actually can make quite a difference. We're also going to go through a number of particular assays, single-cell assays, and we'll make use, in some cases, of image and flow cytometry technology, showing you how you actually make those measurements. And then I'll finish by talking about nanotoxicity in vivo. All of this earlier work is in vitro measurements, single-cell measurements, and that's where a lot of you start. When you start doing developing your nanomedical systems, you'll test them typically on cells in culture, typically human cells, and maybe the human cells of a particular organ, like neurons or heart tissue or lung tissue, something close to what you're actually trying to examine what the nanotoxicity effects are. So we're going to talk about nanotoxicity from the point of view of more or less unintended consequences of using our nanomedical systems. And later on, you'll see that I've rearranged the schedule a little bit. We'll have a full lecture on how do you assess the therapeutic responses of your nanomedical systems. In other words, the therapeutic are intended as opposed to the nanotoxic being the unintended. So we always have to do this not only with our full nanoparticles, but we also want to know the nanotoxicity of the vehicle itself, because you're going to want to put different molecules and drugs inside, packaging inside these systems that you're creating, and the package itself may have toxicity that we have to worry about. So clearly we need to evaluate it with and without the drug inside, just to see how much toxicity is due to the vehicle itself. So we'll go through that, and I've given you a number, again, more papers, and I'll allude to those as we go along through today's lecture. Okay. So when we talk about this, the need for measures of toxicity, the first concept that I really want to get across to you and emphasize, that there's more than one way for a cell to die. And what the consequences are, as we've talked in earlier lecture, that cells have inside them many toxic molecules, so that if you just rupture cells in a very crude fashion, and when we typically just open cells up in a crude way, we're talking about a process called necrosis, as opposed to, as I've discussed previously, the process by which the cell basically recycles all of its internal molecules and components. And we say that apoptosis, or programmed cell death, is the environmentally friendly way to die with regard to its neighbors, so that we don't cause a lot of toxic effects. And apoptosis actually comes from a Greek word of basically meaning leaves falling down. Necrosis is a term that we use when we typically will sacrifice, for example, animals at the end of experiment. We call it necropsy. But we're going to refer to that now at single cell level as necrosis. And I'm going to take you through an important paper that I've given you to read that I think you'll find very useful. These necrosis and apoptosis are not the only two characteristics that we have to worry about in toxicity. We also have to worry about the change of a cell in terms of its proliferation patterns, its differentiation patterns, its basic cell functioning, whether it can do the job that it was designed to do, because we can actually have tissues and organs fail because they have lost their function. The cells are officially still alive, at least by necrosis and apoptosis assays, but they're no longer able to properly function. And that's very important, and we've talked about earlier the side effects that many people have with medicines. Well, quite often what those are is not just cell death, but interrupted function. And so their organs literally stop providing vital functions. And that can lead to very drastic consequences, including death of a patient. And then there are a lot of challenges in measuring the toxicity of nanomaterials because they're submicroscopic. And we need to be able to look over vast areas. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot about that today in terms of biodistribution, but you're going to have a lecture on Thursday where Tricia is going to talk to you about some methods that she's been developing for biodistribution studies. Okay, well, first of all, let's give ourselves a definition of necrosis as unplanned cell injury. And the injury can be a very drastic injury, such that you literally rupture the membrane of the cell and the contents come spilling out, and that happens quite often. There can be a little less severe forms of that, and there are processes that go on in the body when cells in the immune system will attack some cells. They will actually cause small holes in the cell membrane, which then cause loss of the ability of the cell to maintain its isotonicity with regard to the surrounding material fluids that are in there, and so the cell will either swell up or contract down because it's unable because of those holes, it's unable to maintain its proper cell membrane. So think about that as something that's unplanned and can happen in a variety of ways. And I'm going to make the jump to apoptosis, but I am going to tell you that it is possible for a cell to be injured and to repair itself. And actually, the cells in your body do a pretty good job of that. There's actually a lot of cell injury going on. There is a continual repair process, and that has some fascinating concepts with regard to what aging really means. We can extrapolate and say that necrosis is unplanned cell injury, and aging on a more macroscopic scale of tissues and organs and even a total human being is basically a set of unrepaired damage. And our concept of that has changed quite a bit, because we used to think that aging was natural. And now we understand that many aspects of aging are unnatural. They are basically unrepaired damage going between necrosis, where the cell has changed and it's lost part of its function, but it's not been recycled, it's not been regenerated. So necrosis is at single cell level, but we can have important consequences in terms of aging of the person. Now, apoptosis is called planned or programmed cell death. Now, programmed sounds a little strange. You say, well, what does that really mean? What that means is that there is a complete network of signal transduction pathways, multiple ones, in fact, inside the cell, that once you start and basically trigger switches, the cell knows all of the steps, the many steps that it has to go through. So it's actually literally programmed to go from one step to the next. Now, again, what you'll find in apoptosis is that early on, when the cell is stressed, it can make a decision point between, am I going to go into apoptosis or am I going to repair? So I'm trying to tell you that these strict definitions are not entirely strict. So a cell can start exhibiting properties of apoptosis and then seemingly regenerate itself. It will repair itself. And I told you last time, talking about last lecture, about radiation damage to cells. What we found was that when cells were stressed with radiation and there was DNA damage going on, as part of that repair process, they actually exhibited a number of molecules out on the cell surface, which we used as targeting molecules, the same molecules that are upregulated during apoptosis, except that in the case of the radiation, they were transiently expressed. In other words, all of a sudden, those proteins were expressed briefly. There was then an internal decision point in the cell as to whether to repair itself or go fully into apoptosis and die. And so that's an interesting process that you learn that there is a partial, you can go partly down the pathway of apoptosis and still recover. And then there's a point of no return. So we're going to talk a little, we'll see some more examples of that. Okay, why is it important to distinguish between necrosis and apoptosis? And when we say distinguish, we mean distinguishing at the single cell level. And what I would say to you is, whenever possible, we want to avoid necrosis. Necrosis usually is not a good thing, particularly in vivo, because in vivo, unlike in vitro experiments, when we have necrosis, we have the immune system is typically called in to attack cells which are going through necrosis. And so you end up with a very large inflammatory response and sometimes more destruction from the inflammatory response than was there originally. So we, in general, try to avoid necrosis, and we do try to, whenever possible, have the cell shut itself down naturally. Now, this process was not very well understood until the mid-1990s. What was that these different ways of going through death, cell death, could happen. And so what I'm giving you is a review article here by actually a person, Zygmunt Darcinkiewicz, who was a major, major researcher in terms of coming up with single cell assays for distinguishing between necrosis and apoptosis. So this is one of the papers that I've assigned to you, and this one you definitely should read. And what it goes through, it shows you morphologically, first of all, what's happening in the two steps. And you'll see here, during necrosis, very early on, the cell membrane loses its integrity. And things start to leak out, things can come in. And because things can come in, that begs the solution of putting fluorescent molecules or other molecules outside that can go inside a necrotic cell and light it up so that you know that it's dead. So those are called dye exclusion assays. And then the cell starts to fragment much more. Now, unlike that, in apoptosis, the cell membrane, the outer cell membrane, stays intact until almost the very end. Okay, and that has very important consequences, because in necrosis, we're constantly having things flow into the cell and things flowing out of the cell. And in apoptosis, we pretty much don't have things flowing out of the cell. They're simply reprocessed inside the cell. And then only at the very end do you actually start processing things and breaking things down to the point where a cell actually starts to disappear into what's called apoptotic bodies. And that's a fairly fascinating process, because even parts of chromosomes and so on will also be degraded down at that level, and you'll end up with very small pieces, and you'll see those in the assays. So here are some fairly dramatic pictures, and these were taken, they were in that paper, but were actually taken out at the time at Los Alamos, because it took, at that time, a lot of computing power to do confocal microscopy at this level of resolution. So these images were actually taken and done on a supercomputer at Los Alamos National Lab. And so you'll see sort of normal, and you can see, look what happens when you end up with apoptotic cells. And you end up with, in some of these, you'll see red, for example, a red dye, and that's where literally the strandedness. So you'll end up with single strands of RNA as opposed to double-stranded RNA as things start to really unravel and come apart. Now, if you want to, I'm not going to go through all the details of that, but in the copy of the PowerPoint slide that you're going to get, you should be able to be able to read the caption, which is extensive. It's almost like a small article describing each of these pictures and the conditions under which it was done. So here's what I want to do is take you through this process here also of what happens in what we would call a normal cell versus a cancer cell. Now, we would say that all normal cells are eventually going to go through programmed cell death. And that includes all of the cells in your body will go through programmed cell death. And I think I've told you earlier, the fact that you can hold up your hand and see spaces in between your fingers, those were originally webs when you were inside in as a fetus in utero. And what happened is before you were born, apoptosis actually made those cells discarded to go away so that you actually ended up with fingers rather than a web. And that's one of many parts of your body that actually got shaped by apoptosis. So the cells in your body have a certain number of divisions, and the only cells which, as far as we know, which are not programmed to die are your truly primordial, most basic stem cells. That those may have self-renewing potential that go on and on to regenerate parts of your body. And we found stem cells of various types in virtually every organ of the body, and they're there so that they can try to regenerate. The problem is they're not always called in the proper way so that they regenerate the tissue. But all the other cells in your body beyond those primordial stem cells only are capable of going through about 50 to 60 divisions. And then they die. They will never replicate again. And that was a fact found out by Gordon Hayflick, the so-called Hayflick limit, back in the 1960s. And nobody knew why that happened. Now we know that as we go through aging and the cell is eventually going to go into apoptosis after it ages to a certain point, is that we have telomere shortening. The telomeres are the sequences at the ends of your chromosomes. And every time your cell goes through a division, those chromosomes will shorten a little bit. And so eventually they'll reach the point where they can't divide anymore. And they can either stop growing and or be programmed at that point for cell death through apoptosis. As I said, apoptosis is an environmentally friendly way to die because all of the components are recycled and then able to be reused all the way down from DNA and RNA precursors, amino acids. So proteins are broken down into amino acids. All of those things can be reused and repackaged. If a cell doesn't die and it becomes immortalized during, there's another term called oncosis here, meaning becoming a cancer cell, then at that point, what ends up happening is that this process of apoptosis is bypassed and the cell becomes immortal. Now, most of the cell lines that you use in culture, tissue culture, and that we use and you see in most of these papers that we read are effectively cancer cells along this bottom path because they're immortal. They will grow passage after passage after passage. People will grow them. And you've seen probably, you may or may not have seen the recent book about Henrietta Lacks, who was a black woman in the 40s and 50s who came down with cancer, and they took her cells and made a cell, one of the first major cell lines, human cell lines, called HeLa cells. And many of you may use HeLa cells in your work. Those actually came from a patient, and they were immortalized along this pathway. And we still grow HeLa cells today. And interestingly enough, HeLa cells are among the most vigorously growing cells, human cells, that have ever been made. And there was initially some confusion of the fact when people did chromosome studies and chromosome banding for so-called markers, gene markers on those, and they thought that there was contamination going on with other people's cell cultures because HeLa cells do vigorously outgrow any other cells that they come into contact. So if you actually did have them mixed in culture, they would vastly overgrow the other cell types. But what it is that HeLa cells, they started out from a patient, And you can say, yes, they're kind of human cells, but they're really the perfect tissue culture cell. They have gotten rid of everything that they don't need, that's not necessary, and they've optimized themselves for growing a tissue culture. So they have become immortal. So HeLa cells are along this line right here. Well, let's talk about some of the assays. I mentioned to you the most important characteristic between necrosis and apoptosis is that in necrosis, or unplanned cell injury, we always have some damage to the cell membrane. And because of that damage to the cell membrane, not only can things leak out, but if you have things outside the cell, those things outside can go in. And many of you use that in cell studies. You may do a quick cell count when you're doing tissue culture and you use something like trypan blue. Well, trypan blue is a dye that normally cannot get in through the membrane of a living cell or an apoptotic cell, early apoptotic cell. So that's one. Or we have fluorescent dyes like ethidium bromide or propidium iodide that we use that can do that. I'm going to show you some examples. We also have some assays for both early and late apoptosis. And those are, as you get into very late apoptosis, it starts to look like necrosis in some aspects, but it's really not. But there are some aspects about it that change. And so we're going to do a couple of different assays that can be done at single cell level, both flow cytometry or under the microscope, image analysis. And those are very handy assays. And then we will start looking for more subtle. So I'm going down from the most gross damage, highly damaged cells to late apoptosis to early apoptosis, maybe even not committed to apoptosis, in the beginning stages of this, to more subtle assays such as, is there DNA damage going on? For which, as I mentioned to you, our cells get a lot of injury every day. You have millions of cells in your body that are injured and undergoing repair. And so many times they will repair, but there are assays for DNA damage called COMET assays, and we'll go through that. And we can actually check their repair. We can also look at their, because you looked at those morphological changes, people very quickly came up with some very rapid measurements that they could do without any dyes at all, just using sort of the light, laser light scattering off of these, the surfaces of these cells, which had, very distinct characteristics. So I'm going to go through each of those, very quickly and show you some examples. Here's an example of some 85 cells. These are a human T cell that actually has one proviral copy of HIV. So it's used sometimes for studying HIV. It's not capable of transmitting HIV. And so you see the live cells by phase contrast. And then you see that there, if you put a dye such as Herxt, Herxt is a chemical company in Germany, so that's the name of it. And there are a whole series of numbers after that. The common ones that we will use for live cell assays is Herxt 33342. Some of you may have seen this for chromosome studies and other things where you've used Herxt 33258, which is also used. Herxt 33258 is also used to check for contamination in culture, like mycoplasma. So the blue that you see here is basically staining in the nucleus of the cell, and the Herxt dye stains, intercalates into the AT base pairs of the DNA. Not the GC, the AT base pairs. And then the propidium iodide is an analog of ethidium bromide, which many of you also use for gel electrophoresis studies to light up the DNA, for example. So it's a little bit different dye, which is a little more efficient staining. So propidium iodide, is red. And you'll see that there are some cells here which are blue only, and then there are cells which are blue and red. So Herxt goes into all cells, and that's the way that people will typically use, for live cells, they'll use Herxt dye. for, if they have fixed cells and they're doing confocal microscopy, they'll typically use a dye called DAPI. Now, DAPI does not go into live cells. So you need to think about which situation that you have. But in this case, the cells which have damage to that membrane actually have the propidium iodide leak in, and when it goes into the DNA and binds to the DNA, then it turns a very bright red. Now, there's also a couple of interesting things there that you may or may not have observed, and that is that the dye is outside the cell, so why isn't the dye lighting up? Well, it turns out that both the Herxt and the propidium iodide have about 100 times greater quantum efficiency when they bind to DNA as to when it's free, so that you can actually have free dye around outside the cells and you basically never see it, but it's there. And many of these assays actually require you to run, have the cells in the dye permanently because it's a dynamic exchange. So you can see that, and you can readily classify and count, and if you have an appropriate counter, you can do that either manually by your eye, or you can actually have counters which will distinguish between the two colors and do an automatic counting system for you. Okay, let's talk about assays for early and late apoptosis. I'm going to talk about the late apoptosis first, the so-called tunnel assay. And let's talk before we, to be able to have this make some sense to you, for those of you not familiar with the structure of chromatin and DNA, in the nucleus of the cell is not only DNA, but various types of proteins, nuclear proteins, histones, and other such things. And the DNA, you tend to think of it as a double helix here. But in fact, that double helix is then wound around small cores of protein called nucleosomes, and literally wrapped around like this, like beads on a string. And these nucleosomes are on the order, when you put this all together, about 30 nanometers across. So they're actually pretty small. But I'm going to show you a picture shortly, which actually you can actually see these by electron microscopy. And then there's at higher levels, you obviously take all of these structures and you form them into chromosomes, which you would see in a typical karyotype. So there's a lot of coiling. So there's a tremendous amount of DNA packed into a very, very small amount of space. But it all starts, and this particular assay for apoptosis actually depends on the fact that the DNA is wrapped around the nucleosomes. Now, when people did not understand this process 30, 40 years ago, but what they would see is when they put the DNA from cells, and typically cells that were undergoing apoptosis, they would get something called a DNA ladder. And you'll notice these things, it's almost like steps on a ladder. This particular one is just some standards that are put in. But these two lanes right here, numbers 2 and 3, are actually part of what's called a DNA ladder. They had no explanation for what was happening. Why was the DNA cut into very particular sizes? Well, it turns out that if you look back at these nucleosomes, that they're during apoptosis, it's like a pair of molecular scissors going in and cutting the DNA, not always between every one of them, but by sometimes one or two or three of them at a time, so that they come out in multiples. So the reason why you get these ladders is you get different length pieces depending on where you chop between the nucleosomes. It's called internucleosomal cleavage. Okay? And that is what leads us to this laddering effect. And it also, you can see in this picture, and you'll see it more clearly in your own version of this, you see each of these large spots is actually one of these nucleosomes. So these are nucleosomes, and you'll see this little strand, that's the DNA in between. You can actually see these structures now that we have the kind of resolution that we have. So we know then that there are breaks being made, and then when you cut this DNA, that's going to leave a strand that's dangling out there. And we can take advantage of that by putting in labels on those broken strands of DNA. And that's what we're going to do with this assay. So as a late apoptosis assay, you get roughly 200 base pairs in length, although they can be multiples of that. So you get a DNA break. It then leads to the exposure of the 3' hydroxyl ends of the DNA. That indeed allows you to use a terminal deoxynucleotidyl transferase, which is a fancy way of saying that it takes nucleotides and transfers them to the end of the DNA so that you add them on at the end of the DNA. And then at the same time, what we can do is we can take an analog of nucleotides, where we have a DUTP nucleotide, which has a bromine molecule in there, or atom, and you end up with something which can be recognized, believe it or not, by a monoclonal antibody. And so people have then incorporated the bromodeoxyuridine into the DNA and then allowed them to be able to detect it with a monoclonal antibody. And there's actually several other ways. Sometimes this is labeled directly with a fluorescent molecule. So you can do that in a variety of different ways. And then you end up with essentially a fluorescently labeled cell wherever you have DNA damage occurring. And it will actually go in and look at that. Now, it turns out there's going to be also during S phase, as a cell is dividing, there will be some opportunities for this to be taken up. So I'm going to show you a graph in a minute that shows you the difference between those two. So here's the so-called tunnel assay by flow cytometry. So we end up with our double-stranded DNA, and we end up with some breaks along the DNA caused by typically endonucleases. But there can be a whole lot of other damage. We can actually do that as a positive control. We can add the bromodeoxyuridine to the 3' strands with this enzyme as a catalyst to just lay those bromodeoxyuridines at the end of the strand. And then we can come along with an anti-BRDU antibody typically. That may sound like, again, something simple, but it took an old friend of mine over 10 years to actually be able to develop a monoclonal antibody that recognized this sequence here. So it was not an easy thing to do. And then what you end up with is you're basically then trying to label these cells so that you can flow them through a flow cytometer one at a time. And when you do that, you can end up with, you're going to stain them for the DNA. Typically this test, you always will fix the cells and you'll stain the DNA. So you'll end up with a normal DNA histogram of G0 and G1, S phase and G2. And now these cells are basically not cycling. When you have S phase cells, they're taking up the bromodeoxyuridine, so they'll label. In fact, this is also, we used to call it the immunologist way of doing cell cycle analysis, so that you didn't have to do any mathematics. You could just go up here and do a simple box here and count the number of S phase cells. But the apoptotic cells are in between. So those are all these cells, and you'll see that they're spread across the cell cycle all the way between G1 and G2. And they can occur, basically cell death can occur anywhere in there. So this shows you a typical assay. Now, what is the effectiveness of the tunnel? We can have a negative control and a positive control. And this may sound like a strange positive control, 100 micromolar hydrogen peroxide in there. But believe it or not, there is hydrogen peroxide inside many cells in your body. And when it's released, it can create the conditions which lead to apoptosis in surrounding cells. So that's a case where a cell may die, may leak out hydrogen peroxide, and may induce apoptosis in surrounding cells, even if it's not enough to actually kill them. And so when you do this negative control and you have along this axis your fluorescent bromodeoxyuridine labeling, that along the x-axis, then you'll notice it's basically down at, this is a log scale, so this is basically autofluorescent levels. I have a small amount of apoptotic cells. There are always some apoptotic cells. And then in this case, we see a very large peak in the B fraction, where these cells have been induced into apoptosis. So here's the naturally occurrings, few percent, and now we've got a very large percent. So as a positive control, and this would be our typical case. Now, it turns out that when you try to measure the toxicity of particles, by necrosis assays or you know, straight injury assays, you typically, with iron oxide nanoparticles, will never see much toxicity. But if you start looking at apoptosis, then even in the tunnel assay at various concentrations, you'll notice along the x-axis is a light scatter signal, and the y-axis is the fluorescent labeling of all of those nucleotides that are going in with the bromodeoxyuridine, being added to the parts of the DNA which have been nicked and damaged. And so cells, your background level is about where I have the horizontal line here, and then above that line is our cells, which are basically positive for measuring by this assay for apoptosis. So you'll see that we can get, depending on what the dose is, we have positive control here in the B fraction. In the C, we have some that are, so here's our positive control, and we see that we have a very small amount of toxicity of the cells by the iron oxide. In fact, it's really not much above background. So iron oxide is again a very non-toxic, even when we try to measure it like this, unless we put, as I've warned you, very, very unrealistically large numbers on tissue culture cells, where you use thousands of times more than would be in any way reasonable if you were doing it in a vivo assay. So, as I said, that doesn't really count. You can't blame the toxicity of the iron oxide. You're just massively crowding out the cell surface with things and causing disturbances on the basis of that. Okay. As I said, you don't tend to see much late-stage apoptosis, and in vivo, you almost never see tunnel-positive cells. That's tends to be a tissue culture assay. You just don't see them in vivo because the cells are destroyed and taken out of the body. So people wanted to look at something that was much more sensitive, much more early. So what they found was there was a molecule called phosphatidylserine, which occurs on the surface of cells undergoing apoptosis very early on. Normally, this protein is buried inside on the inner side of the membrane. So it goes from the inner side in a live cell to the outer side in a cell undergoing apoptosis. So here's your live cell. Here's your phosphatidylserine, which is on the inner part of the bilayer, lipid bilayer of membrane of a cell. So you normally wouldn't see it. When a cell is apoptotic, then you can take an annexin 5. That's a ligand. It's again sort of a ligand receptor here. And you can attach a fluorescent molecule to it, and you can buy these things commercially with many different fluorochromes of different colors on it. So you can pick the one that of best use to you for your total experiment. So here I've shown a red dye on an annexin 5. As a cell is apoptotic, then what you have is the phosphatidylserine has now gone to the outer side and is able to bind the annexin 5. And a late apoptotic cell, what we start having very late in apoptosis, we start getting leaky membranes. That's the point where we start leaking things both in and out. And as part of that process, what we end up with is not only labeling on the outside, but we can have a dye exclusion. So we can have a different dye of a different color that can go through and label, in this case, the nucleus and light it up. So we would be able to tell that This is an early apoptosis cell because the cell membrane is still intact. It's excluding any dye that's out here. So the nucleus is negative. And we can see the annexin 5 binding on the outside. Late in apoptosis, we not only have the annexin 5 binding, but we have a brightly lit nucleus with whatever the dye exclusion. So you're now combining a dye exclusion assay to distinguish between late apoptosis and early apoptosis with annexin 5 assays. So this is a very valuable assay. You'll see this a lot in the literature. Very sensitive assay. And here's some flow cytometry results. This particular one is using an Alexa 488. That's a dye which excites at 488 with a blue laser at that wavelength and then fluoresces green. And so this is basically measuring propidium iodide, so dye exclusion on this axis, and Alexa 488 on this axis. So we have dead cells and live cells with the stain, and we can see apoptotic cells in this region right here. Okay, so we may want to, again, verify. We think that there's damage going on, but how do we really know that on a cell-by-cell basis? So a totally different type of assay, known as a COMET assay, and we've talked about this briefly in a previous lecture, but the basic idea of that is as the DNA starts to get degraded, little pieces of DNA, the cell membrane may be a little bit leaky, and so the very small pieces of DNA can go out. And when they do, they go out, they're able to be labeled, and we can actually see that in what looks like a COMET tail. So we can actually assay that, and when the spot is pretty much just straight around the nucleus and you don't see any tail, then we say at that point that we're not seeing signs of DNA damage. Now, this is where COMET assay, and I showed you in the previous lecture about some of the radiation damaged cells that we were able to put in an enzyme, a glycosylase that was missing in that second DNA repair pathway that's missing in our bodies that we were able to repair. And what you saw was cells which had a COMET pattern, and then after that second pathway kicked in, we actually reduced and no longer saw the COMET tail. So that is a case of a cell which underwent DNA damage but was able to repair itself. And that happens a lot. We have a lot of DNA damage caused by things like oxidative stress proteins in our bodies that's going on all the time. Luckily, DNA is a very repairable molecule. It always has that convenient other second strand, so that if we lose a nucleotide on one strand, it knows what that nucleotide should have been by looking at the other strand. So we can go, and we have many different repair pathways that can go back and actually fix DNA damage. So sometimes it's repairable and sometimes it's not. We can also do light scatter assays. Particularly, this is again showing flow cytometry assays. So if we have a forward scatter on the y-axis and a 90 degrees away from the direction of the laser beam coming in on the x-axis here, what we see is two populations on here, and the black dots here are shown that we have some MCF7 human breast cancer cell lines that we incubated with different concentrations of amino activated groups on the surface of quantum dots. And so these cells that are in black had no exposure to quantum dots, and the cells that are shown where each of these dots in red represents one or more cells at that XY coordinate point at different concentrations. And so we can actually see at different molar concentrations of quantum dots that we get. It's a little hard to see from this that it's worse at 80 nanomolar than it is at 8 nanomolar, but a lot of the damage is already happening at 8 nanomolar. And so these cells here are the cells which are undergoing apoptosis and have changed their light scatter patterns. And why has that happened? Their light scatter, actually at 90 degrees is greater. So what's happened is, remember you saw all those undulations on the outside of the cell? What that'll do, if you put a cell that has those undulations on the cell surface through a flow cytometer, you'll get a very big 90 degree light scatter signal. And you'll tend to get a smaller forward scatter signal, which tends to look at the sort of the main body because the cell is starting to shrink. And that's what happens during apoptosis, is the cell shrinks, but it gets a very wavy surface. So that allows you to make a very quick test. And actually, you can see here, it's a pretty fast and easy if you have a homogeneously sized cell line. That only works if it's homogeneously sized. If you have a lot of different cell types present of different sizes, then they'll get confused in there. But if you have a pretty much one size cell, and you do this, then it'll be quite sensitive just to measure the light scatter properties. And that's a 5-minute test. That's even faster. The other assays that I showed you will take you anywhere from 1 to about 3 hours to do. Now, one of the things that people, when quantum dot nanoparticles were made, people got the idea that they could put those inside, have them taken up inside a cell, and then they could actually watch the uptake as cells took up more and more of these quantum dots, and they could also look at cell division. So the idea being that if, for example, if a cell took up 100 quantum dots and it divided into two daughter cells, that it might roughly divide into 50 cells, 50 quantum dots in each of the daughter cells. So you could actually, and then if those cells divided yet again, then those daughter cells would have half of the original. So then they would have on the order of 25 quantum dots. So people said, gee, that's a great way to be able to watch cell divisions, count how many times a cell's divided, and follow cells in culture under various types of treatments. So what I show here are some simple histograms of quantum dots that we took in our laboratory, taken up by MCF7. So you see basically in this, from the back to the front, starting out with no quantum dots, we pretty much have an autofluorescent peak, and then we start seeing quantum dots taken up in the first 15 minutes. They then increase up to about 8 hours or so, and then after 24 hours, those cells were dividing, so they were actually coming back into fewer numbers, and these are pretty wide distributions. So people thought that this was a great way, and if they could follow this, then obviously the quantum dots were not very toxic. Now, one of the things that you already know is that nanomaterials in general don't go into aqueous phase solutions like water, like salt water, things that cells normally exist in. So what do? We surround those nanomaterials with various types of hydrophilic molecules or biocoatings that we put on so that we can get them to go into solution. Well, what ends up happening is that when they sold these quantum dots, they were actually you can still buy them. They're called Q trackers because they were tracking what happened during cell division. They said, oh, well, these are not toxic. Well, what people were not looking carefully at was the fact that the quantum dots themselves were reasonably toxic, but they were surrounded with a biocoating. So depending on what type of cell that you put them in, so some cells you put them in and you could actually grow them for 2 to 3 weeks in tissue culture and not see any signs of toxicity. The reason is that the nanomaterials were always covered up with biocompatible coatings. Other cell types, and people, it was a big dispute in the literature. You look in the literature and it looks very confusing, where some people will say, you know, that they're not toxic at all, and other people would say, oh, they killed my cells in a day. And what was the difference? Well, in the cells that were killed in a day, there were enzymes inside the cell which chewed away the biocoating so that the nanomaterials were exposed. The other thing that happened is sometimes people had their cultures exposed to light. Well, it turns out that light, particularly once you take the biocoating off the surface of quantum dots, then light will break down the quantum dot structure, the nanostructure. Now, it turns out that quantum dot nanomaterials are a lot less toxic than the elemental forms that are in there. But what happens is when you shine light, and particularly bright intensity light, on to quantum dots, then you start releasing the elemental cadmium in particular, for example. That's the most common element in a quantum dot. There are many different types of quantum dots, but that one is particularly toxic. When you shine a light, it goes into elemental cadmium. Cadmium is a known toxic agent that is very dangerous to human cells. So you need to think about this in terms of your assay. How long are you doing it? What are you trying to do? It depends on your cell type. That may work for your cell type, or it may not work at all for your cell type. So in vitro studies can be done very well, but I think the result of this, when this started coming out in the literature, people started seeing that there really was some toxicity. That pretty much made it such that we were not going to put quantum dots inside the human body. And so these so-called first-generation quantum dots are great for in vitro tests and or ex vivo tests outside, where you take a blood sample outside and maybe use them or on a tissue or on just tissue culture cells. But there are new generation quantum dots being developed, which will hopefully be less toxic, made out of zinc and manganese and other substances that we will be able to start putting them in the body. The neat thing about them is that they're very brightly fluorescent and that they can be imaged for a very long time. So you could do very deep imaging through tissue without photobleaching, which normally you cannot do. So let's go a little further with this. And one of my graduate students was doing quantum dot studies. We're doing sort of what we call rapid prototyping of nanomedical systems in animals. And we're also doing tissue culture. And when I looked at her tissue culture cells, having looked at a lot of tissue culture cells over the last 30 years, I looked and I said, those cells are very unhappy. And yet, the cells that she was monitoring were not showing any signs of necrosis by traditional assays, so completely dye excluding. So they were trypan blue negative, propionium iodide negative. When we did they were tunnel negative assays. They were annexin 5 negative, showing no signs of any apoptosis. But I looked at those cells and I kept looking at them and I said, those are unhappy cells. There's something wrong there. So what we came up with was another very simple assay that you all can use. And it's, I think, becoming much, very, very much popular because it's a very easy, simple assay. You can, in a matter of minutes, you can do the assay. Very, very easy test. And basically what it is a molecule called dihydroethidium, which is normally not fluorescent unless it interacts with reactive oxygen species proteins. And when it does, it then cleaves the portions of the molecule and then makes it fluorescent. So what you see in the control here, control panel A, is basically virtually no background. This is just sort of autofluorescent background coming through this set of filters. When I use my hydrogen peroxide positive control, and it's good to know what you can do positive controls with. So here's one here, and you see the nuclei of the cells light up, fairly bright red. And this assay here in C was with the Q-tracker. Now these green particles were the actual quantum dots. And again, they weren't single quantum dots. They were clustered. But, and we have admittedly a lot of quantum dots here. So this was one that was it is dose dependent. But you can see here, these cells, if you didn't use dihydroethidium, again, were tunnel negative, annexin 5 negative, they were trypan blue and propionium iodide negative. And yet, once you put the dihydroethidium on, you could see these cells were very unhappy, they were undergoing DNA damage, and generating a lot of reactive oxygen species proteins. So this is something that people hadn't seen in the literature. They hadn't applied these these tests. So what we're saying is be aware of that, that you need to walk your way through the series of tests that I've showed you, the grossest test being the dye exclusion. But just because it's trypan blue negative or propidium iodide negative doesn't mean that that cell isn't dying, okay, or injured, or down at the level where even it just looks a little unhappy, where in this case we have DNA damage going on. And we can do those kinds of assays quite easily. So, so far all I've been doing is talking about in vitro or ex vivo assays. So what happens when you're actually in vivo? Single cell nanotoxicity is a very difficult thing to assay inside an animal. And that's typically, or a person, where you would have to have biopsied tissue or necropsied material from the animals. And then you would have to look locally at that. And now what that is, there's not been a large amount of work done on nanoparticle toxicity at the tissue and organ level. And what that, the reason is that there are very few pathologists trained in terms of nanoparticles and nanoparticle toxicity. So what it's going to take is some bright young pathologists figuring out how to look at tissue and walk their way through tissue samples from animals. Right, Abby? Abby will be doing her PhD thesis on that as a pathologist. So it's very hard to do that, but we need to follow that through and actually look not only at cell death, but what ends up happening to the tissue architecture, what happens, as we would say, the pathology of the tissue, which causes the tissue or organ to have altered or failed function. And that's where doing toxicity at the tissue and organ level becomes a challenging thing. But it's also a rich area to be studied because there's so many other things going on in vivo in terms of filtration, accumulation, homing of nanomaterials to different parts of the body. And so that's something that has to be done with tissue and organ level type examination. And when we talk about the body, we're also talking about the size. We've talked about this over and over. The size of nanomaterials is important. And there are two main regions of size. If the particles are very big and they get into the bloodstream, then what's going to happen is they're going to tend to lodge into the lungs. And that's where you'll see it first. And so one of the papers I've also given you to read is by Gunter Oberduster, who is probably the world's best nanotoxicologist when it comes to materials and size, and particularly on toxicology of the lung. He's made quite a study of that over the years. So if the size is large, you're going to see it first in the lung. You're going to see also, that's where you're going to see clumps of nanoparticles lodging in the lung. And then smaller sizes get filtered by the liver. And then smaller sizes yet will tend to be filtered out by the kidneys. And when you actually look at these in an animal, and we'll see some later studies of this, some animal studies where we're doing simultaneously fluorescent imaging in whole body animals. We can do this only in small mice where we can get enough depth to be actually look at the nanoparticles fluorescently labeled in the tissues and organs. And then we can actually necropsy those organs out and actually get a semi-quantitative measure of the distributions of nanoparticles in those tissues and organs. And we're going to see that in a later lecture. But that way we can actually get some idea what's happening organ by organ through the animal. As I said, we can actually do whole animal studies and actually do that as a function of time so that you can watch the animal filtering out many of the nanoparticles, and you can actually see them going out through the kidneys and excreted in the urine and the feces of the animal, or collecting up and getting increasingly where they go increasing concentrations into the liver. or if they're targeted to a tumor, increasingly targeted into the tumor region, and everything else sort of filtering out. So we'll study that in much more detail, but ways to actually look at these particles as they're traveling around in the body. So here are some, just finish with this, some challenges to evaluating the toxicity of nanomaterials. First of all, remember that just because you've done this assembly of nanomaterials, those materials may be very different from their elemental forms. You've made them maybe less toxic by putting them together in a new form. And as we said, nanomaterials are new forms of matter. But they can also break down when they're in there. In particular, they can break down with exposure to light and pH changes. Again, when they're in highly acidic environments, you may strip off biocoatings, you may start to break down the actual nanomaterials. And that may be different by different types of cell types. So it can be tissue, type, and cell type, very, very different results. And then the overall take-home message is that toxicity is not just outright killing of cells, but as a complicated function of a number of variables, not only simple and rapid cell death, but also apoptosis. It can affect cell proliferation. Typically what it'll do is shut down cell proliferation unless we do that switch over from where we actually cause DNA damage and the cell goes into oncosis, in which case it gets immortalized and the proliferation rate can go up. And one of the things about that you have to be very careful is that there is a mythology that says that all cancer cells are dividing faster than normal cells. And that's not always true. There are many cancers that actually are not dividing any faster than the normal cells around them. They just don't stop. They don't go into programmed cell death, so they keep right on going. So it's an exponential duplication of the cells, of the cancer cells, whereas we end up with a leveling off of the normal cells. So cancer cells can have proliferation rates from as low as 5 or 10%, which is very much for many of your normal cells, or they can be as high as 80% or more, in which case they're just completely cycling all the time. Cell differentiation can be disrupted. If that happens, remember, your body works to make different types of cells. The differentiation process has to work to make all the different differentiated cell types that are present in the different types of tissues. If you disrupt that, then you can disrupt the tissue or even the organ. You can also change the cell function. If the cell is not able to do what it's supposed to do, then we can consider that a toxic effect. Even if the cell is alive, even if it goes through all of these assays that I've shown you today, we can still say that there is a toxic effect if any of these things, including things such as changes in cell function, happen. And lastly, I want to remind you that when we're constructing these nano vehicles for drug gene delivery for treating disease, one of the things that we're going to want to do that's really important is we're going to want to develop a vehicle which, in and of itself, the vehicle without any drugs added or genes added to it, is very non-toxic. What you'd like to be able to do is switch in and out targeting molecules, switch in and out drug delivery, but make a vehicle that you can use over and over again. This is going to be particularly important because if we're going to develop things that are going to go through human investigations, then what we want to have is a way that we know that the vehicle is of low toxicity, and then when we add a targeting molecule, then the only thing we have to worry about is what's the difference between the targeting molecule added on, the toxicity of that, versus the vehicle itself. So this is very important if we're going to be able to rapidly prototype and develop a vehicle good for a lot of different diseases. If you have to start from scratch every time, then it'll be a very long, painful process, and nanomedicine is going to go at a very, very slow pace. And so this is when I gave an invited lecture to the FDA, I stressed to them that it's very important that we be able to evaluate the vehicle itself and come up with something that we can use and reuse over and over again without having to evaluate everything. And unfortunately, the FDA does not have a policy for that yet, and they're not used to considering things in that mode. So if we think about the nanoparticle in this last item here as like a car, and you being the drugs inside the car being delivered someplace, then you would think that there are certain things that you ought to be able to alter on the car, small things that wouldn't take much. But their view on it was that if you approve the car from the ground up, every single step up the way, approve the car and then change the windshield wipers, you would have to start all over again reapproving the car from the ground up. So I think what we need to do is decide, you know, the whole is not always the sum of the parts. Sometimes when you add something, it can change the relationship between things in there. But many types, particularly when we're making these vehicles for nanoparticle for delivery systems, we really are not changing things much, and we can try to invoke the idea that the whole is the sum of the parts unless there's something very unusual going on, and then we can just evaluate the particular things that we've added to the main vehicle. So that's what this last item is about, is to make a platform technology so that you can embed many drugs. If we can do that successfully, we're going to see a very rapid growth of nanomedicine, because why would you want to deliver drugs any other way? So with that, I've given you a number of references here, those are all up on the website now and ready for your reading pleasure. So I think I've caught up with all of the those of you that have had a break from reading for a while. Now your break is over, and you had to have something to do during your October break. So now you've got a lot of papers. So I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Yeah, go ahead.
If we go to the light scatter assay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I can do that. Yep, this one right here.
There is I don't quite understand this slide because there is a green.
Well, you're not. Yeah, unfortunately, I think what's happening is that this is an additive process, so that we're ending up getting a different color by combination. I think what should be showing on here, you can clearly see the black dots.
Right.
So those ones say that we have less side scatter. Every XY coordinate point represents one or more cell. If there's two of them on top of them with the same coordinates, you can't tell the difference with a dot plot assay here. We could get more sophisticated. But so we see these points right here in black have a lower side scatter. That means they have a smoother cell surface, because that's what side scatter is going to be very susceptible to. When we have a cell undergoing apoptosis, remember the rather wild undulations on the surface that are characteristic of that, that's going to scatter a lot of light at 90 degrees. And so these cells, for a given value of X in an XY pair here, they have a much greater side scatter compared to its size. So we have different size cells here. So, and again, the other thing that's happening is the cell itself, it's getting more undulations on the surface, but it's also shrinking. And that's a known characteristic of apoptosis, is that you're starting to have the cell shrink. The membrane's intact, but the cell is starting to shrink. So that's all that this is doing. Unfortunately, this isn't very clear in this. It might be a little bit better on your personal copy. But all I was trying to show is a very clear delineation. You can see the red from the black at 8 nanomolar. And then there should be a little bit more. I think it's just a little hard to see the green in there. It's somewhat dose dependent.
But.
The blue is, I think, what's happening is when we have a combination of colors on top of it here. Maybe, actually, I think this one is supposed to be blue. I think that's the problem, is that came out green. Let me go back and check that. I'm not quite sure why that came out green.
So it seems that...
So it should be black, red, and blue. Yeah.
So it seems that the concentration, because the red and the blue are the same location essentially?
Well, they're very close, but if you actually did a quantitative measure of that, you'd find that the blue is, and let's assume that this is wrong, that this should be blue. And I'll try to go back and fix that for you. If you actually did a quantitation of all the points, it's hard to see by eye. You'd see that there's probably a little more with the blue, but there's a threshold effect that says at 8 nanomolars, you've pretty much launched the cells. And that was part of what I was also trying to show with this, is that, yes, there may be dose dependence, but there's also a threshold effect. As long as you get up above a certain amount of them, then it doesn't matter. If you add more, you know, kill the cells dead and kill them again. Okay? You can only kill them once. So this is what's happening here. I'll fix that point. That really should be blue, not green. Not quite sure why. Sure.
The slide with the dye exclusion, I'll say for necrosis.
Okay. Let's go again. This one? Okay.
I didn't understand how they are identifying the apoptotic cells in this case.
Well, the answer is it's for this particular one, this dye exclusion assay. We say that propidium iodide is a dye which will only go into a cell with a very leaky membrane, typically a necrotic cell, which has holes in the membrane. And so here, basically, you have all the dye, the Herxt, in this case, Herxt-33342, will go into all cells and will light them up in blue. And the propidium iodide will only go into the cells that are leaky membranes. And when you start looking at these, and the only way that to answer what your question is, how do we know what's an apoptotic cell versus a, and you're gonna have to focus in on some of the cells in terms of the morphology of the DNA. So what ends up happening, you're going to have to look at this and sort of blow it up on your screen, your computer screen. But what you'll find is that instead of being a round nucleus, you'll start having these lobules of similar to what happens with neutrophils in the body, where you end up with the DNA is in these funny little patches. And that's what happens during apoptosis. So if you look in that, you'll see most of this is necrotic, but there's some late stage apoptosis in there that where the things are starting to get leaky, but you're only going to see it in the ones where the nucleus is lobed in very late stage apoptosis.
So we are looking at the fluorescent signal, right?
We're looking at the fluorescent signal, and if you did that in a flow cytometer, you would see both blue and red in those cells as opposed to blue alone.
Would we have that kind of resolution to see those?
Depends on how big the cells are and what magnification. Typically, if you're going to see good lobular structure for late stage apoptosis on the DNA, you'll need to be up at in somewhere between 40x or even 100x in oil. You won't see that at 10x or 20x unless the cells are very, very large. So you need a pretty good resolution. And that makes it hard to scan, right? Because if you have to use 100x in oil, you aren't going to scan across the slide very far. So it's easier to pick that up by flow cytometry. Other questions? Okay.